This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Talk is about to begin. Hey, 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 come on in.
Welcome back to your Thursday Buckeye Talk from Cleveland.com. Mini version of Rants. Doug Lamorese here by myself. We're going to talk about 9-3. We're going to talk about Jim Tressel. We're going to talk about Kevin Warren, former Big Ten commissioner. We're going to talk about Michigan having to fire somebody they just hired and what that means. We're going to talk about offensive line. We're going to talk about could any ACC teams ever join the Big Ten. So we're going to run through a lot of stuff, but we'll start off the top because we had a texter send me a message that was like, hey, how come the guys who were among Kevin Warren's biggest defenders haven't talked about the aftermath of Kevin Warren and what's been reported about the Big Ten TV deal? And I did not know that we were among Kevin Warren's biggest defenders. I think the Kevin Warren tenure is weird more than anything. I was going to say complicated, but it's mostly weird. And so the thing that's difficult in evaluating him is that it seemed like he went out on top. So Kevin Warren left the Big Ten to become the president of the Chicago Bears, which I feel like is like a sideways move at best, or probably a down move. And it's like he didn't really want to be the Big Ten commissioner. He was in the NFL. He came to the Big Ten. He used the Big Ten to get another NFL job, which is fine, but it's like not much for the old legacy meter. But the best thing he did was this new team. The two best things that Kevin Warren did were the USC-UCLA addition, which it feels like maybe USC and UCLA came crawling to the Big Ten, and anybody who was the Big Ten commissioner would have been like, hey, welcome. But you still, I don't know, you did it. You didn't say no, even if maybe you weren't the driving force of it. And then the new TV deal, that the TV deal was up. The Big Ten was just in an advantageous situation with the way the clock worked compared to some other conferences, and they made a lot of money on the TV deal. And now there are questions coming out about the TV deal. And is it as good as it was reported? And did he give up things that the schools weren't ready to give up? And does it have a direct effect on the fans as a result, which is mostly night games in November? And some of it, and most of this reporting, is from Pete Thamel at ESPN, and Pete is probably the best college sports reporter out there. I will say, and how do I say this? And I trust Pete's reporting implicitly, and I think we all should. But also, he now works for ESPN, and the Big Ten did not sign a deal with ESPN in its new contract, and the ESPN is now going to televise the SEC, and they're not starting in 24, and they're not part of the Big Ten TV deal. So I'm not questioning Pete's reporting. I do think ESPN people maybe, which is just how reporting works, ESPN people may, not Pete, but the people involved in the negotiations might be very excited to get this story out there. But I do not question the veracity of Pete's reporting. So the bottom line is two things that have come out of Pete's reporting. One is that Kevin Warren promised the 2026 Big Ten football championship game to NBC without clearing it with Fox. And since Fox and the Big Ten Network, and since Fox has become, like, in the last TV contract, kind of became first among equals with ESPN, you know, more like the 51% to 49% in that arrangement, we've seen, right, the Big Ten championship game is on Fox. That's a huge property. That's a big deal. And apparently Kevin Warren promised that away without clearing it. And the result is, according to Pete's reporting, that Fox is saying, well, the Big Ten owes us $40 million now because they evaluated that the Big Ten championship game is a $40 million product, and they are getting one fewer of those in the current TV deal than they expected because they expected all of them. So that's $40 million divided by all the member schools. You know, it's not the end of the world, but it's $40 million less on the total thing. Another thing that Pete has reported is that, like, not all the details are worked out, that the new commissioner is coming in and figuring out a lot of the, you know, final signatures and that kind of thing, and that generally the overall worth of the deal may be a little less than reported. I don't know if substantially less, but less. And this is one of those things when this stuff like this gets reported and you can't necessarily, like, just demand the contract, you're at the mercy a little bit of, like, what people tell you things are. So it does feel like, from the reporting, that Kevin Warren did his thing at the end, said how great it was. It wasn't as great as he said, and then he left. So that's not great for the old legacy, Kev. And the other thing is that this NBC TV deal, which is, as we know, starting this season, and then it's really going to be full-throated in 24 because CBS will be all the way in with the Big Ten in 24. In 23, this season, CBS is still doing some SEC games, so CBS is like split SEC and Big Ten. But the bottom line, the default way of thinking about it is big-time noon games on Fox for the Big Ten in this new TV deal, mid-afternoon games, 3:30, that's going to be CBS, and primetime games are going to be NBC. And part of the deal, apparently, is that NBC really wanted these night games, especially in November, and that the Big Ten, especially Ohio State, Michigan, and Michigan State, weren't all in on that. And that Pete is referencing in his reporting these things called tolerances. And he talked about that on a podcast, and he was like, man, the Big Ten has these tolerances, and, you know, people, I don't even know if everybody knew what these were. We are familiar with tolerances. That's a phrase that Gene Smith has used a lot over the years. So the way the Big Ten operated, and in the end, Urban Meyer beat some of the gentleman's agreement kind of stuff out of the Big Ten of, like, let's all just work together as friends. And it was like, listen, man, like, are we doing this or not? Is this a business? Like, yes, we're in the same conference, but also we're out for ourselves. What are we doing here? Tolerances and the way they've been expressed in the Big Ten in the past is a little bit of a gentleman's agreement. And I think they might need rules. So the tolerances are, as Gene Smith would explain it, schools could say to the TV networks, we'll do this, but we don't want to play a road game on this day. We don't want to play night games at this time. We don't want to have this. Like, are you open to a Black Friday game the day after Thanksgiving? Yes or no? Would you tolerate that playing on Friday? No, we would not. Yes, we would. Would you tolerate opening at night on the road in Big Ten play, like Ohio State did at Minnesota a couple years ago? Yes, we would tolerate that. Would you tolerate a night game at your place in November? So there, once upon a time, right, 10, 15 years ago, we'd talk about Big Ten doesn't play night games at November. I think it evolved into, like, schools, especially some schools, said, we don't tolerate that. Like, that's, we don't want that. And the Big Ten adhered to it. And so it feels like, the way Pete reported it, that, like, Kevin Warren kind of, like, didn't communicate the tolerances to NBC. NBC signs a deal with the Big Ten that is based on primetime games all year. And now they're finding out, hey, Ohio State, Michigan, Penn State don't want to play at night in November. And NBC is like, well, we have primetime games for you guys. What are you talking about? You have to tolerate it. So we see Penn State and Michigan State playing a Friday night Black Friday game, Thanksgiving week, in Ford Field in Detroit at night. We see Ohio State hosting Michigan State on November 11th at night. That is not what they want to do, and I think these schools are giving in because the deal's done. But from the reporting, including some quotes from Ryan Day and Chris Holtman, they're doing it sort of like under duress because the deal's been made and now NBC's expecting it. And maybe Kevin Warren, according to the reporting, along the way didn't communicate to everybody. He made the deal with NBC without telling the big-time schools, hey, you're going to have to do this. And now the deal's done, and now what? So now it's up to the big schools to agree to it. And so there's some hurt feelings there. So the idea of like, what did Kevin Warren do for the Big Ten? It's like, well, he came in, COVID started, he tried to lead. And I think it's good for the Big Ten to lead. He tried to lead and say, we're not playing football, and sort of thought the world might follow. And I think caution is good. Health and safety of the players is good. Health and safety of fans is good. The Pac-12 kind of followed. Nobody else did. Fans, parents rallied, players, coaches, programs rallied, said, we do want to play. So then they changed their mind. Big Ten changed their mind. They did play. But that, all of that, did Kevin Warren look good in that? Probably not. I don't think it was a ridiculous thing to do, but like, he tried to lead with no authority because he had just gotten there. That's not his fault. He didn't have any. He was new. And it didn't exactly work. And then, you know, like, that lingered for a long time. And then it kind of was USC, UCLA, the TV deal. And now he's out. And now the TV deal is like, what's up? Kev, what are you doing, man? So I think the Big Ten as a group just needs to establish more firm parameters, no more tolerances, like yes or no, this is how we do it, this is how we don't do it. But also, you can't take all the money and not expect to give in on certain areas. Like, that's what the money's for. Isn't that from a movie? That's what the money's for. Sometimes you get paid to do things you don't want to do. It's like, do you want to play night games in November? No. Do you want $55 million per school in the TV deal or whatever it is? Yes. Okay. Well, you can't have both. You either got to take less money or you got to play the night games in November. So like, on some level, I don't feel bad for the Big Ten because you make a deal with the devil. And am I saying that the devil is TV? Oh, the TV is going to ruin these. I don't know. I don't mean the devil. I watch TV. I'll be honest. I'll admit that here. I'm not afraid to admit that. I watch television. So that's the way it is. It's clunky, though, and it's not great. And the lack of communication is the problem. But it's like, but what are you going to do now? The guy's gone. You're just going to make sure that you're never going to have that kind of lack of communication again over situations like this. And I do think, right, there was sort of with the COVID stuff that felt like, maybe was the communication not great. So maybe in the end, Kev's communication skills, not the best. I just don't like, I get offended generally when I feel like jobs that to me are not stepping stone jobs are used as stepping stone jobs. And I don't think Big Ten commissioner is a stepping stone job to president of the Chicago Bears. So that affects my view of Kevin Warren. Because it's like, what? Like, you were just here for that? It's Big Ten commissioner. You're potentially one of the two most powerful people in college athletics. Not just one sport, not just football. All of college athletics, you can shape the future of an entire system, not just a sport. And it's like, now I want to build a stadium for the Bears. It's like, okay, I don't know. So yeah, it's not great. And so in the end, how does it affect you? Well, Ohio State's playing Michigan State at night in November. Is it the end of the world? We'll see how cold it is on November 11th at night. But they've got to work that out. But also, the deal's set and NBC is locked in. NBC wants this. I think it's at least 8 primetime games a year. So I don't know if you guys have looked at the calendar lately, but I don't think you can just only do those in September and October. And that's not what they want. It's like, let's jam all these in and make... So like, they're paying for it. So in the end, the Big Ten's going to have to pay some money back, some COVID-related money that maybe wasn't communicated, this Big Ten championship game on NBC that wasn't communicated. They're going to have to pay some money back. Maybe the totality of the package is not what was reported. That's mostly semantics. Will they have enough money in the end? Yes, they'll have enough money because it's all tied into, you know, the current thing. Even with the current deal, all the TV, all the distributions for all the schools among various conferences came out recently. Final numbers for the last fiscal year, it's about $59 million per school for the Big Ten, about $50 million per school for the SEC, about $43 million per school for the Big 12, about $40 million per school for the ACC, about $37 million per school for the Pac-12. So the Big Ten is giving out $22 million more per school than the Pac-12. That's why USC and UCLA are coming. So part of the issue, too, is that the strength of the Big Ten is its TV deal. The eyeballs that these schools attract, mostly Ohio State and Michigan, which translates to TV money, which makes everybody want to come join your conference, which then translates to more TV money. So when you start messing with the TV financial numbers and fudging those, that's the heartbeat of your existence. So maybe like don't mess around with that. So that's not great either. Is it going to blow up the Big Ten? No. Is it going to tarnish Kevin Warren's legacy? Yes. Is it going to cost everybody in the Big Ten a little bit of their giant financial windfall? Yes. Is it going to make some of the big time programs play night games in November that they don't want to play? Yes, at least for a short period of time. So that's the effect on you. I'm sorry about that. I'm sorry if you're going to be cold at Michigan State. No, not at Michigan State. Ohio State hosting Michigan State on November 11th. But like, that's not only Kevin Warren, that's the Big Ten prioritizing money. As I always said, like, what are you going to do with it? So they build a bunch of facilities. They fund all these programs. I will say a little bit to me, just the tiny bit of discussion that we've had this year with other Ohio State sports. Ty Tucker, the men's tennis program, just finished second in the country for the third time in his tenure in outdoor tennis. They lose the national championship match to Virginia, but that Ohio State is the second best outdoor men's tennis team in the country is crazy. That's not what they should be, but they are. They're that good. Women's hockey, right? National champs. Last year, this year, make the national championship game. Now they're trying to build a new arena for that. That's part of this. You see the success of the wrestling team. That's part of this. And I'm missing a bunch, right? There's a lot of success among the Olympic sports at Ohio State. And so what do you do with the money there? That's some of what they're doing. And they are getting some bang for the buck on that. They're having Ohio State athletes and programs have success, partially because they're funded, partially because Ohio State makes a bunch of money in football driving this TV contract. So that's reality. If you want to, like, people like to be mad at Kevin Warren, part of which is, I think, commissioner is a thing that people like to be mad at. You're in a tough spot. You wind up doing a lot of hardcore negotiations. There's a lot of give and take, and inevitably on the give, no matter how much the take is, sometimes fans, people like us, media, don't want to give. Why are you giving this up? Well, there's a lot of take. Right now, we're finding out the take wasn't as high as you thought. So that really makes people question the give. All right. That's Kevin Warren. We wanted to start there. We'll get into a little bit more money stuff at the end. We'll get into a Michigan situation at the end. But let's get back on the football field. And this is someone who contends they are not trolling me. It's from the 513. Let me start by saying that I'm not trolling you, and I'm generally positive as a Buckeye fan. Doug, I think your 9-3 reasoning from 2019 could be spot on for this year. One, I'd take the uncertainties on players and coaches going into 2019 over this year. Trying to put aside some 2020 hindsight, my biggest concern is the O-line. I just don't know how issues there don't basically mess up the entire offensive playbook. Two, the 2023 schedule is far more difficult, in my opinion. In 2019, we didn't play a ranked team until week 8, and it was Wisconsin at home. Notre Dame, Wisconsin, and Michigan are on the road this year. Penn State and Michigan are potentially at their recent best forms of themselves. If Notre Dame figures out a way to attack our line, the others will follow in force. That's Matt in Indy. Treading the ground of 9-3. It's dangerous ground, Matt. All I can say is watch yourself. So, I think it's an interesting conversation. I think the schedule thing is inarguable. The schedule thing is inarguable. It's much more difficult this year. The thing that led me to 9-3 in 2019 was the absolute inexperience of the head coach and the quarterback and their inexperience with each other. Ryan Day, other than the three games at the start of 2018, had never been a head coach at any level. And now he's tasked with running this program. Justin Fields had been a wrinkle quarterback at Georgia, showed up in January and was basically like, hey, save us. Run this offense. You just got here. You're going to have about 8 months in the program before you take the field as a starting quarterback. Here you go. So if we want to compare Brian Hartline as never called plays before, that's like Ryan Day. Well, Brian Hartline doesn't have to run the whole deal. So I thought 2019 was more of a risk. And then Kyle McCord has never been a starting quarterback before other than the one game against Akron 2 years ago, but he's been around for 2 years. He's not completely new to things. like Justin Fields was. Now, do I think in the end that Kyle McCord has the raw talent, is as natural of a quarterback as Justin Fields? No, I would take Justin Fields, but it wasn't that I questioned Ryan Day and Justin Fields in their abilities to be a good head coach and a good quarterback. It was, I wondered if they'd get to it together right away. And maybe it would take a full year of figuring it out and bumps along the way to figure it out. So that's why I don't see this season the same way. I think there's, yes, there are changes, but there's, that was structural to me. That was more like the systems in place. Urban Meyer, yes, Urban Meyer had built something up, but you're passing it off. And now the guy in charge, the two people in charge, the head coach and the quarterback are new. Here, it's more ancillary things that are new. Brian Hartline as a play caller and questions about the offensive line. So maybe there weren't such specific football questions about the 2019 team. And I do think you had more problem solvers. Chase Young's a problem solver. Justin Fields turned out to be a great problem solver. Jeff Okuda's a problem solver. Chris Olave is a problem solver. Well, maybe things aren't perfect, but those dudes will save us. Marvin Harrison Jr. is a problem solver for this team. Tommy Eichenberg's probably a problem solver for this team. Denzel Burke, JT Tuimoloau might be problem solvers for this team. Emeka Buka is a problem solver. The run game, Travion Henderson, Mayan Williams might be problem solvers. So I know what you're saying. I think the schedule is the strongest point, that they're not toss-up games. They're not toss-up games, but they're real games. At Notre Dame's a real game. At Wisconsin's a real game. Penn State at home, at Michigan, all real games. So then you get to a point, I thought with the 9-3 team, it's more like, and by the way, at that time, in 19, we're coming off 17-18 when Ohio State had lost two games you didn't see coming. They lose at Iowa in 17, they lose at Purdue in 18. So it's like, all right, well, this is what's been happening, and now it's a new head coach and a quarterback who just got here. I thought things like that were more possible. That's not where we are with this team, right? This is, we had the big game conversation with this team. I don't think we're at the game you didn't see coming out of nowhere spot with this Ohio State program right now. So that, I think, that is a little bit of it to me as well. So I understand where you're coming from. I don't think you're wrong, but I'm not as far there. And because to me, is it possible, and we have plenty of time to make predictions, is it possible that Ohio State loses a game or two? Yeah. I mean, it's possible that Ohio State loses a game or two. But to get to 3 in the regular season is quite a thing. And I'm not there yet. I'll just tell you, looking at the FanDuel Sports app right now, Ohio State's favored by 28 in the opener against Indiana. Most of the opening week lines are out. Week 4 at Notre Dame, Ohio State is favored by 7. Okay? Ohio State's favored by 7 at Notre Dame. And I think that to me is enough of, that's a borderline toss-up game. And I think that line will move for sure if Ohio State proves its quarterback play is good. That line will move, and I think it's a good chance that Ohio State's, you know, a 10-point favorite by the time you get to that game. But there's some uncertainty around the Ohio State quarterback. 7-point line right now. Penn State game on October 21st, Ohio State at home favored by 10.5 in that game. That, I think, could move higher for Ohio State by the time we get there. At Wisconsin, October 28th, Ohio State favored by 10. On the road, Ohio State still favored by 10. And then the Ohio State-Michigan game, and we are probably at the point where this should be its own podcast. Oh, November 11th, home against Michigan State, Ohio State favored by 24.5 right now. That probably seems right to me. And then the Ohio State-Michigan game is Ohio State, a 2.5-point underdog at Michigan. So we're talking about tough games. So that's one game where Ohio State right now is an underdog, and three games where Ohio State is favored by 10.5 or fewer points, which for Ohio State's pretty unusual. So I'll take that point. I think it's an interesting and educated way of thinking. I'll tell you, even as much as we've talked about the offensive line, when it's just football, I do think more often than not, Ohio State figures it out, like 95% of the time. When it's structural, that's the issue to me. And I even think if you look at 2020, there was just something like the structural elements of the defense weren't good enough, and you required a change there. I think when you look at 2004 Ohio State, last time of a real reset year, four-loss regular season, that's structural. That's quarterback uncertainty that sort of sticks the whole year, that they can't it's Justin Zwick, and then the middle of the year they get to Troy Smith, and in within that, it's like a transformation. As much as we don't know who the quarterback's going to be, I don't think it's going to be that either. So I think the structural Brian Hartline as a play caller, because the thing, like, if the Brian Hartline play caller thing doesn't work out, I think they just pull it back. And would you lose three games where that's a part of it? Like, offensive play calling is a somewhat major contributing factor to three losses in the regular season. I would doubt that. Because even in 2020, when you make the defensive change, and you could say, okay, the Oregon loss, there's a lot of defense there. They make the change. They lose to Michigan. There's some things against Michigan defensively. Well, they made the change, but they went from Kerry Combs to Matt Barnes. If you make the change offensively this year, going back to Ryan Day, you have the guy sitting right there. It's like, oh, who's your interim offensive coordinator? It's the head coach who's been the offensive coordinator. It's not Matt Barnes. It's more of a backup plan. So it's not as structural, but I understand what you're saying. But I am not there. And if I was there, I would tell you. I am pretty sure, I am 99.9% sure I'm not picking Ohio State to go 9-3 in the regular season this year. But I would not shy away from it just because I was fundamentally, drastically, memorably wrong to the point that it is the defining part of my career, of my nearly 30-year career as a sports writer and my nearly 20-year career covering Ohio State football. The defining aspect of it is that I said Ohio State would be 9-3 in 2019. Would that scare me off going there again? It would not, but I'm not there. All right, when we come back, we'll talk offensive line and Jim Tressel next on Buckeye Talk.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Back on Buckeye Talk, Doug LaMaurice. Hey, if you want to be a tech subscriber and have great rants, ask great questions, love the tech subscribers. I love all the listeners. I do. The listeners of this podcast are like the sixth most important people in my lives, and the texters are fifth, and everybody above them is I'm related to. I spend a lot of time with you guys. So all listeners, thank you. All texters, thank you. If you want to be a texter, 614-350-3315. You send a text to that, you get a link back, you get a two-week free trial. Matt in California from the 949. This is more of a question than a rant. But can you see a similar season arc to this year's offensive line compared to the 2014 O-line? Very shaky early on, especially in pass protection, and then obviously evolved into a dominant run-blocking, good pass pro line. In reviewing the rosters, having Taylor Decker on the 14 line is the one clear personnel difference between the two, but I'm curious if you think this could happen again in 2023. It's a good comparison. I like it. I think one of the things that can help us most is looking for ways to compare Ohio State to itself. So the offensive line is this line that develops, that Urban Meyer talks about. Like, he gets here, the offensive line's a mess, like, guys for the first meeting, they're late, whatever. And they round into form in 12, and then like in 13, they're great. But you lose four of the five starters from 13. You lose Jack Muhort at left tackle, Andrew Norwell at left guard, Corey Linsley at center, Marcus Hall at right guard. And Muhort's a second round pick. Norwell goes undrafted crazily, but winds up making a gazillion dollars in the NFL because he's a Pro Bowl level offensive lineman. Corey Linsley's one of the best centers in the NFL. So that's how good those guys were. You're losing them off 13. You have one starter back 13 into 14. You have two starters back 22 into 23. So Taylor Decker is moving from right tackle to left tackle for 2014. He's a top 100 national recruit. He's a big time dude. You knew he was a future left tackle. The most important spot on the offensive line is locked down. No doubt about it. Taylor Decker's going to be good. That's a huge difference, as the texter acknowledges. But still, it's only one returning starter compared to two this year in Matthew Jones and Donovan Jackson at the two guard spots. So who else are you working in 2014? Well, you're working in Pat Elflein, who's played at some. He had taken over when Marcus Hall got kicked out of the Michigan game in 2013, and he starts in the Big Ten championship game in 2013. Pat Elflein plays well at the end of 2013 and gives you an idea. This guy can start in 2014. We believe in this guy. He starts at left guard. Right guard, Billy Price. I remember now, we did not know for sure that he was going to win a job. I think Joel Hale was in line, maybe as a veteran, to be that guard. And Billy Price, again, borderline top 100 national recruit, had come here as a defensive lineman, switches to offensive line as a redshirt freshman, wins a starting job. They put a lot on him. And then in talking to him later, after Billy Price started for 4 years, that was rough on him. He heard the criticisms, and people were criticizing him early. That's a young guy in a tough spot. It's a little bit like Carson Hinsman this year, right? Carson Hinsman's a second-year guy. Billy Price was a second-year guy. You're a pretty high recruit. It's not completely unreasonable to ask you to start in year two, but it's also a little bit of a heavy lift. And Billy Price winds up being really good. Some struggles early that year, though. And then you lock in two older guys who are not huge recruits. Jacoby Bourne at center, had been the backup center the year before, and Darryl Baldwin as the right tackle. And so this is this two-year period, 14-15. Ohio State plays Darryl Baldwin at right tackle in 14, Chase Ferris at right tackle in 15. They're both fifth-year guys, one-year starters when they do it, and we sort of develop this thing. We're like, oh, that's okay. So, like, that would be good too, right? So I will say I don't think it's an unrealistic arc with the texter asking, could maybe you struggle a little bit in pass protection early on? Everybody loves to run block. You get the run game going. The run blocking builds confidence, and then by the end, you're good enough in pass protection. I do think that arc is possible. But in trying to compare the pathways, I am somewhat significantly more apprehensive now, because I think when you look at the line in 2014, you have a lockdown left tackle, all right? That's a sure thing. I would say this year you have two sure things, left guard and right guard. That's great to have two instead of one, but left tackle is more important. You're then leaning on a young guy to play right away. And Billy Price and Carson Hinsman, I think, is similar. You then have Pat Elflein, who had played and you kind of believed in. So that's maybe a second guy to believe in. So then we're now, I think, at the point where if we take Donovan Jackson, Carson Hinsman at center, and Matthew Jones at guard, and we'll compare them to Taylor Decker at left tackle, Pat Elflein at left guard, and Billy Price at right guard. I think the left tackle part of it's really important, but that's not an unreasonable thing. Now, can you get Jacoby Bourne and Darryl Baldwin level of play out of the guys you're asking now, out of left tackle and right tackle? So, at right tackle, none of those guys are fifth-year guys in the program like Darryl Baldwin was. You're asking Zed Mihalski as a third-year guy, Tegra Shabola as a second-year guy, or Joshua Simmons as a second-year guy, first-year guy in the program as a transfer. Can you do it? Okay. I think that's a bigger ask than you had to ask Darryl Baldwin. And then Jacoby Bourne to Josh Fryer, I don't think is dissimilar. Jacoby Bourne was a junior in 2014. I don't think that's completely dissimilar to Josh Fryer, except Josh Fryer is at the most important position. And center's really important. And I do think if Josh Fryer is a Jacoby Bourne level player, I think that's good enough for Ohio State. I do. But there's just more at risk at left tackle. So I think at right tackle, there's more options, but there's not like an old guy to lean on like Darryl Baldwin. and the Born Fryer thing are similar, but left tackle is just higher stakes than center. So I would say I am more apprehensive about this line than the 14 line, but I think it's a good comparison. And I think the path to the progress is possible for sure. But also, that 14 team lost in the second week of the year because they couldn't block anybody. Because they had a new quarterback, like they do this year. They had a new offensive line, and Virginia Tech threw a defensive strategy at them that they weren't ready for. So, you know, if you're comparing that path, I think you're also bracing for like a maybe a week four problem against Notre Dame. But then can it come out the backside? Hey, remember when the offensive line and the quarterback didn't play that well against Notre Dame? And remember when they got it together and by the end of the year, they were the national champs? You'd take that path too. So I think it's a really good question, and we're always looking for comparisons here. Somebody asked this about Jim Tressel. I was on a podcast recently. I think it came out this week that I could direct you to. It was based out of Youngstown, and we talked a lot about Jim Tressel. And then I think the person, Justin, who interviewed me was then like at something with Jim Tressel. And said hi to Jim Tressel for me. Jim Tressel said, hey, back. It's the 330 Sports Show with Justin Coffin. I was on with him. And so since it's a Youngstown show, he was talking about asking me about Jim Tressel a little bit and the difference, you know, covering Urban Meyer to Ryan Day to Jim Tressel, that kind of thing. So this is this question, though. From the 541, is Jim Tressel the second to last head coach to win a national championship while calling plays? Especially on offense. So we had had this conversation where Jimbo Fisher in 2013 for Florida State is the last. And a lot of that is because Nick Saban doesn't call plays. And Dabo Swinney doesn't call plays. And Kirby Smart doesn't call plays. Kirby Smart's called plays at times, but like he's not the primary play caller on defense right now. So when you have those guys and they take up a lot of the titles, then it's like, oh, there hasn't been one. And so I looked and there's an awful lot between 2002 and 2013, there's like an awful lot of Alabama still in there, an awful lot of Saban, and like an awful lot of Pete Carroll. And so I think that's right. I do think the last two head coaches to be primary play callers are Jimbo Fisher in 2013 and Jim Tressel in 2002. So we had referenced this that I think Ryan Day giving up play calling is a good thing. And then it's like, oh, well, Tress never had to do it. Right. And it's like, well, Tress is still like an exception to that rule. So I feel like Ryan Day is doing something that maybe wasn't asked of other Ohio State coaches. Urban was not the primary play caller. But it's just common out there in the world. But it's just an interesting point to bring up that that's how far back it is. And again, you guys who were following Ohio State in the mid 2000s, you know that Jim Tressel giving up play calling was a constant conversation in the second half of his career here. And so Ryan Day is giving it up at the beginning of that conversation. And Ryan Day is a more dynamic play caller. He has a different strategy. He wants to get after it more than Tressel did. I'm not saying better, different strategies. Tressel, special teams, defense, don't put your defense in a bad spot offensively and win a whole bunch of games that way. And then, by the way, line up Ted Ginn Jr. as a receiver in the Michigan game and get a touchdown out of it in the biggest game of the year. So, like, Tress had a little something for you, too. But Jim Tressel loved it. And again, I've told this story a million times. I try to be very aware of not being the old man who tells the same stories again and again and again. But there's a lot of things that are happening to me. And I think you guys can, those of you who are older can relate to this. When you're young, you look at older people and you think, why do they do that? And then you get to be older and you're like, well, of course you do this. And it's like, it's not that old people are dumb. It's that when you get older, there are things that are just easier to do, so you do them. Or there are things that are harder to do, so you don't do them. And you just live your life. And then you think to yourself, I'm sorry, old people, for the way I either treated you or thought about you previously, because it makes sense to me now that I'm old. So there's a couple things here that I'm talking about. One is I now carry Sweet and Low with me. We have it. My wife has it in her purse. I have it in my car because Sweet and Low, the pink packets, mix better with coffee and unsweetened iced tea than Splenda or Equal or, God forbid, Real Sugar. Real Sugar is just drops to the bottom of it, doesn't mix at all. So there's a lot of places that don't have sweet and low. So if I'm getting coffee at McDonald's, they only have Equal and Splenda. I want sweet and low, so I carry sweet and low. But my grandmother carried sweet and low. There's a joke in the first season of Friends about the grandmother in that show having thousands of sweet and low packets in her closet. And it's like, ha ha, I'm young, you're old, you have sweet and low, you're dumb. And then it's like, oh no, carrying sweet and low once you're almost 50 makes total sense, because it by far mixes the best. All right, so that's one. Another one for me. I actually had an eye surgery that fixed my eyes, but my eyes, like, I had to wear readers, right? I always wore contacts, but I had to wear reading glasses because I couldn't see up close anymore, especially like I'm trying to read stuff for a pod. So I had to wear reading glasses, and I was constantly misplacing my reading glasses, and I didn't know where they were. And I was like, you know what would really help this? If I had them on a chain around my neck, because then you don't lose your reading glasses. So you'll, when you're young, you're like, why are you wearing your glasses decoratively? And then it's like, it's because I lose them constantly. And also, now I'm old, I don't care what you think. I just don't want to lose my glasses anymore. So that's a real thing. My third thing that I've been experiencing is my hair is thinning on top. And you reach the point, it's like, I'm never going to be one of those. Like, I have never dyed my hair. I'm not going the Mike Krzyzewski route, but it's like, I'm not going to be one of the comb over guys or whatever. And just got my hair cut yesterday. My haircut person left, and now I had to get a new haircut person. And my old haircut person who I trusted, we had talked about, like, all right, it's getting thin up there. Can we push it a certain way? Can we kind of slide it down the mountain a little bit and make sure we're covering what needs to be covered? And I don't ever want to go the full comb over route, but I am much further down the line of arranging my hair to cover bald spots. And I'm not close to bald yet. I don't want to exaggerate it, but it is a conversation that I am having in my head with my hairstylist and now on a podcast. And I never thought I'd be there. I was like, hair's hair. What are you going to do? And it's like, no, it's not as much as it used to be. Let's move stuff around a little bit. So, I can't even remember where what launched this idea of why. Oh, telling stories again and again and again. I knew I was going to get there. I knew it. Oh, that's still coming. Losing your train of thought by the time you get to the end of a thought. Not all the way there yet. You'll know when I'm there all the way, because you'll be suffering through it. I've told this story multiple times, but I sometimes can't remember when I tell it in real life, when I tell it on Buckeye Talk, or when I tell it on another podcast, or when I tell it on a radio appearance. But one of my primary memories of covering Ohio State, we used to do a lot more interviews inside the Woody Hayes Athletic Center because they had a media room that Jim Tressel built for us in the middle of the building. And he was very proud of it. We did a lot of interview stuff in there. The 2008 season, when Terrell Pryor was starting quarterback for the first time, we would work in that room. We'd have like major interviews after practice, like on a Wednesday. And then we'd work in that room. And then if you were one of the people who were really there covering everything, they'd bring in Terrell Pryor unannounced into that media room in the middle of the building. And it maybe wouldn't be if you're just a person that only shows up for the head coach talking and you're not here for the offensive guard or the punter or the safety, then you don't get Terrell Pryor, because we're not going to tell you that Terrell Pryor is going to talk. We're just going to tell you it's a punter, a guard, and a safety. And if you come for the punter, the guard, and the safety, then maybe Terrell Pryor will show up as a bonus. And it would be in this media room. And then they realized, like, we're letting them in the building, because you'd be in the building. It's like, oh, there's Beanie Wells in a boot walking down the hall. And it's like, well, now I know that. So they don't let us in the heart of the building like that anymore, which I miss, but I understand why they don't do it. But I remember standing in that hallway outside that room and I asked Jim Tressel, would you consider give up play calling? I remember everybody's thing back then was Mike Martz, the greatest show on turf. Should you bring in Mike Martz as the offensive play caller? And Tressel said, what am I supposed to do? Eat bonbons? And that was his thing of like, if I'm not calling plays as the head coach, like, what am I doing? So Tress never got there. Tress never gave it up. But he's also back to 2002. There's only one head coach calling plays since then to win a national title. So thinking more about Tress, it's not that I feel guilty, but it's like, Ryan Day, you have to give this up. And it's like, Tress never did. We sure did ask him about it a lot, though. And like, could they have won more if he had given it up? That's not a conversation I'm going to have here in the middle of a rants pod. could they have won more? If in 2009 or 2010, could you have avoided the Purdue loss in 09? Could you have avoided the Wisconsin loss in 10? If you have a play caller that allows Tress to focus on structure, leadership, motivation, and then you maybe get just different ideas in the room, a little more innovation, a little more risk. I don't know. I'm going to have to think about that one. Because in the end, it's like, well, can you really argue with the final results? But they had some good teams that at the end, you know, they're not, I don't think they're get, they didn't lose to Florida in the 06 national title game because of play calling offensively. They didn't lose to LSU because of play calling offensively. I wouldn't say that. They didn't lose to USC in 08 because of play calling offensively. They did play a really low scoring game in 09 against USC at home. And then when you think about Purdue and you think about Wisconsin, could they have gotten over the top if Tress had done what Ryan Day is now preparing to do? Okay, write that down. I don't know. I need to think about that. But yes, by my calculations, Jim Tressel is the second most recent head coach to win a national title while calling plays. All right, let's do another Tress. From the 440, with Youngstown State coming to Ohio State this year, should Ohio State put Jim Tressel in the ring of honor and let him dot the I? So I do think these are separate things. Gene Smith talked about that on his recent podcast, that dotting the I is up to the band. And so Earl Bruce dotted the I in 2016 at the age of 85. And Earl Bruce left us a couple years later. I thought that was a very nice moment. I know it meant a lot to Earl Bruce. I thought it was appropriate. I thought it was a very nice, well-earned moment for a dedicated, loyal Buckeye and Earl Bruce and for the fan base. Could you do that with Tress? I think you could. And would it be the most appropriate for the Youngstown State game? I think it would. And I don't know when they're going to play Youngstown State again. They played Youngstown State when Tress was here. And they wedged in this Youngstown State game. They only announced it last year because they were supposed to play San Jose State in this game. And they canceled that contract and they wedged in Youngstown State instead. They don't play FCS schools anymore. So this is kind of a weird one. They might never play Youngstown State again. So to have those two schools together, also, if you announced it, you'd sell some tickets for that game that you wouldn't sell otherwise. So that's not a bad idea. Tress is 70. Earl was 85. So, like, do you have to, is it a now or never proposition for Jim Tressel for dotting the I? No, it's not. You could certainly do it down the road. Is it now or something that will feel a little less thematic when you do it? If you don't do it against Youngstown State? Yeah, I think this is probably the best time to do it. So I think they're removed enough to do it. And I think I would vote for it. It's just different. And I do think, by the way, there is part of this that Jim Tressel now retiring from Youngstown State, I think opens this up a little bit more as well. That Jim Tressel is retired on February 1st from Youngstown State. And so now he is back. He's everybody's Jim Tressel again. That he's not like, oh, it's like, hey, Ohio State's honoring me. It's like, well, I'm a Youngstown State guy. I run the university. So once you're retired, you belong to a part of your previous, everything you've done in your life is now back in play because you're not dedicated to one thing. So I do think that changes now. It's like, hey, Ohio State's going to have the Youngstown State president dot the I. It's like, well, I don't know. Is that a little bit weird? Even if it is Jim Tressel. Now he's not that. Now he's just Jim Tressel, former Ohio State football coach. Former Youngstown State football coach, former Youngstown State president. He's all those things again. When you're the Youngstown State president, that's what you are first and foremost. So to have him dot the I when those two teams play, there's a lot I like about that. And I don't know who would stand up and say no. Say, no, this is not appropriate. If Bob Hope's dotted the I and Jack Nicklaus has dotted the I and Woody Hayes has dotted the I or Earl Bruce has dotted the I, no. Jim Tressel right now doesn't fit that. We can't do that. I don't know who would stand up and say that. And so Ring of Honor is great. I think like the dotting of the I is a little more like front and center to me in this question because that's a moment. And like a Ring of Honor thing you can do whenever. But like dotting the I for Ohio State, Youngstown State. I think I'm in favor for it, and I gotta call the band and ask. And it's one of these things. I always think, like, we're going to plant the seed that'll make it happen. It's like, is that how it really works? Do we plant seeds that make things happen? Probably not. But maybe I'll call and ask them about that. All right, last couple things to talk about here on Buckeye Talk after this. All right, so the ACC's been mucking around. This was a question from a couple weeks ago. From an Ohio State perspective, would it be good for the ACC to blow up, leading to possibly more expansion? That's Roger in Athens. So the ACC, there was this report that seven of them were talking to each other about trying to get out of their current deal. Basically, everybody calls it this, like, it's called a grant of rights deal, and it's basically the ownership of your TV rights and all this kind of stuff. And it's like the big, and you sign a contract and it's there for a long time. And like to get out of the, it's like the TV contract and the agreement that the conference makes among its members to say, we're going to be in a conference together. To break that costs a lot of money. But would you possibly be willing to go to court to break it? Could you get like the big dogs in the group to work together to break it? Would you just say, we'll pay the penalty to break it? But the reports were that Florida State, Clemson, Miami, North Carolina State, Virginia, and Virginia Tech were thinking about trying to break that, the grant of rights contract. And then they had these meetings recently, like this week, it came out, and they agreed to a new model of money distribution that feels like maybe it's going to save the ACC. So I know that you guys, it's like, hey, did you guys listen to Buckeye Talk? They talked about ACC financials. It was awesome. It's not why you're here. So we'll do this in 30 seconds. They basically agreed they're going to pay out in football based on how well you do in the postseason, which just means they're going to pay the teams that make the 12-team playoff more money. So the whole thing in college football conferences is, do you pay everybody everything equally? And that's what Ohio State and the Big Ten have done forever. The Big 12 did not do that with Texas. It blew up the Big 12 as a result. They still are doing it in the Pac-12, which means that USC is like driving the boat in the Pac-12, but they're not getting more money there because it's equal distribution, and that equal distribution is significantly lower than the Big Ten, so they want to jump to the Big Ten. So I think the ACC has hit on something. They are going to pay it out. It's like the NCAA basketball tournament, that when you advance further in the tournament, you get more money. And then that goes to your conference pocket, but I think some of it comes to your pocket directly too. So like the Big 12, when they gave Texas more money, that was based on Texas being Texas, just that you're more popular. You get more TV eyeballs, you get more money. This is based on performance. So that the farther you advance, the more money you get. And maybe it's Wake Forest, and maybe it's Georgia Tech, or maybe it's Clemson or Florida State or Miami. So being popular and being good is often related. Historically, it is. Usually you're historically good, which is how you got popular. But it doesn't mean the same thing at all. You can be popular and not be good. So tying it to performance rather than tying it to TV ratings, or just saying Ohio State's going to take a bigger chunk, Michigan's going to take a bigger chunk because they're Ohio State, Michigan. If the Big Ten said, hey, you can earn it. But in the 12-team playoff world, we're like, if you make the 12-team playoff, we're going to give you more money for that. That's what the ACC is doing now. They've agreed to that. It probably is going to save the ACC. And so what does that mean for the Big Ten? I do think the most popular schools and best, I think if the ACC ever dies, I think Clemson, Miami, Florida State, I think they're headed for the SEC. If someone wants to fight back on that and say, no, I'll tell you why Miami's a better fit for the Big Ten, like, that's fine. They're in the South, man. I don't know what to tell you. If the ACC exploded, I do think that drives Notre Dame to the Big Ten, because now Notre Dame doesn't have a home for all its non-football sports in the ACC. So that would be the biggest thing. I think it drives Notre Dame to the Big Ten. Would the Big Ten then also potentially be interested in North Carolina? Then you probably got to take North Carolina State. But North Carolina, Virginia, Virginia Tech, Georgia Tech? Like Georgia Tech in Atlanta? That, I think, is real, right? I think that's possible. Do you fold Pitt in now? Do you fold Boston College in now? Like, I don't think Dabo's ever going to be in the Big Ten. So, like, the big-time football schools, I would say no. Florida State, Miami, Clemson. Some of the other schools that could be, like, interesting, I think would be possible. I also think It's possible that the remnants of the ACC, like if Clemson, Miami, Florida State went to the SEC, I think you could see like a basketball first conference that still plays football, but like a Duke, North Carolina, Virginia, like basketball conference form on the East Coast. That could be fun. And it's like they play football, but the reason they exist is basketball. So in the end, I think it would have, if the ACC did explode, which I don't think it's going to do anymore, at least not tomorrow, I think it could have some effect on the Big Ten. I think they would be interested in some of those, but I think the number one thing would be enhancing the possibilities of Notre Dame coming to the Big Ten. All right, this is the last one, and it's about something that happened at Michigan that we do want to talk about. And it's that Shemi Shembeckler, Bo's kid, who actually I think lives in Columbus, was hired at Michigan and then immediately was let go. And it was weird and dumb. And there were a lot of headlines. This, I thought Chris Vanini at The Athletic did a good job. This was a headline. Michigan leadership continues to embarrass itself after Shemi Shembeckler mess. So he had been hired as the assistant director of recruiting. He'd been an NFL scout for a long time. Like Shemi's just kind of around. And so he was there for like less than a week. And they figured out that he had said some dumb stuff on social, like offensive stuff, not dumb, offensive, racist stuff on social media. He had liked tweets saying that slavery and Jim Crow laws were good for black people. He'd liked a tweet that compared a member of Congress to an African tribe. And he had liked some transphobic comments and some political conspiracies. So they fired him. And again, I don't mean to read Chris's whole story. I just thought he did a good job. He said, like, this is the only way this has happened. A is Michigan did a background check on Shemi Shembeckler, didn't find this stuff. And it's like, well, then your background check stinks. They did a background check. They saw this stuff and they hired him anyway. Or they didn't do a background check at all, which just means that like Jim Harbaugh can just do whatever he wants. And I think that is the three options. And so none of those are great. It's hard when you have a successful coach who keeps threatening to leave. Sometimes you wind up giving in to him. This is Bo's kid. Jim Harbaugh is intimately connected to Bo Shembeckler. And so like you just can't like people have different political views in the world and within a football building, but you can't have public views like that in a world where you are hired as part of, you know, directly being the structure overseeing young men. And some of them are young black men and you're liking tweets that slavery was good for black people. It's like, you just can't have that. Like it's a non-starter. This is not political, right? That's not a political thing. And so I do think it's kind of hard to believe. If this happened at Ohio State, we'd be ripping Ohio State for doing this. Like, what are you doing? And it doesn't mean you can't have people in your building who have different views of the world. And Ohio State certainly does. Every program certainly does. There are different views of the world on the football team. But it's just like you can't be, when you're in a position of leadership, when you are part of the structure at the top of an organization. I do think, and I've been thinking about this a little bit with Jim Brown, the passing of Jim Brown. I wrote about Jim Brown when he passed, and that Jim Brown had very credible accusations of violence against women. He, throughout his life, on both sides of the political spectrum within the world of social justice, had strong opinions, acted very strongly according to what he believed that might have angered people in various ways. But Jim Brown, like, nobody was hiring Jim Brown to be the coach of the Browns or general manager. Like, Jim Brown as an individual, he ran an organization that was trying to get rid of gangs. But when you're an individual, you can think whatever you want privately or publicly, but you're mostly just in charge of you. And if people think like, I can't believe that guy said that, I can't believe that guy did that, I can't believe that woman behaves that way, it's like, well, it's just about you. And then you get credit, get praise, suffer any consequences individually. But if Jim Brown, with the credible accusations of violence against women in his past, had tried to get hired as a head coach in the NFL, that becomes a much bigger circumstance because now you're in charge of people. Now you're representing an organization. You're not just representing yourself. And as a player, you are representing an organization. And we see the NFL, for instance, penalize players for off-field acts all the time. The NBA is doing that with Ja Morant right now, right? So, But even when you are a, one of the bosses, right, in the leadership structure, it's just different. And so Shemi Shembeckler was liking these social media posts, whatever, in his life, and he's an NFL scout, whatever. But if you're going to get hired into a college program, like, you just can't do that. And so, like, Michigan botched it by hiring him. And like, I think it absolutely, we have to ask questions about that. Like, what are they doing? Did they think it wasn't a big deal? Did they miss it? Or do they not even do it? As Jim Harbaugh reached the point of he can do whatever the heck he wants to do, that is probably the most dangerous. And it's the kind of thing that's like Kirk Ferentz territory, that Jim Harbaugh is not related to Shemi Shembeckler by blood, but he's related by Michigan blood. He's related by blue and maize blood, right? I mean, the Harbaughs and the Shembecklers, they may as well be related. So Kirk Ferentz is doing whatever he wants to do with Brian Ferentz. My kid's the offensive coordinator because he's my kid and I can do whatever I want to do. Terrible for the program. Terrible. Shouldn't be allowed. Jim Harbaugh, he's Shemi Shembeckler. He should be here. I'm going to hire him. If that's what happened without a background check, terrible. That's a bad sign for your program. So that was not great. It was not a good thing for Michigan. They got out of it quickly. So credit to them for solving it quickly. But, and then in the end, and this happened with Bob Huggins too, like Bob Huggins used the F slur on a radio interview. And it's one of those things where whenever things, because Shemi Shembeckler, like at 10 o'clock at night, I got it in my email inbox. They must have emailed it to every single college football writer in the country. It was like the longest, most convoluted, most PR-ish apology. So it's great. It's good to issue an apology. That's great. But we know the deal with this stuff. When you say things like that, like Bob Huggins did, or you have a history of social media activity that reflects that, and then it comes up, all that happened is that you accidentally publicly revealed what you really think. And now you're caught. And you are worried about being penalized for it. So it's not that you don't think it. It's that you mistakenly let the world know that you think it. So, like, we know the deal. So, it doesn't mean that there aren't people that think that way. There might be people listening to this that think that way. But you're probably not going to get hired by a college football team in a position of any kind of power. So that's the reality here. We're not the thought police here, but we just have to realize that, like, you know, when you have that kind of position. So, like, Shemi Shembeckler, whoops. Oh, here are these numerous instances on social media. At least he didn't say it was hacked. Oh, I'm sorry. It's like, are you? Are you just sorry that now you now realize that everybody knows what you think and it cost you a job? Okay. That's it. We'll come back. Ohio State, Michigan recruiting is the plan for the Friday podcast. Steven and I will be here on that. Got some good stuff planned for next week. We always appreciate you guys being a part of it. Text subscribers, 614-350-3315. Make sure you're subscribed to Buckeye Talk. Read Buckeye Talk. We're finishing up our Michigan week at cleveland.com/OSU. College Football Survivor Show. The most recent episode should be out Friday, is the 17 teams of the playoff era that would have been helped the most by a 12-team playoff from 2014 through last season. And guess what? Ohio State teams are in that mix. So go check out the College Football Survivor Show. For now, I'm Doug LaMaurice, and that was Buckeye Talk.